Hey folks, Rob Orman here, and this is the MCrit Podcast. So kind of unusual that for the past 199 episodes, you've heard Weingart say those words, but for this show, we're going to turn the tables. This is episode 200 and get into the mind of MCrit. See, what makes Scott tick? What's he think about this or that? Where did this guy come from? Did he just, rise out of the clay and suddenly there was Weingart? Or was there a little Scotty Weingart who now is in his 40s but still has a 16-year-old picture on his driver's license? True story.
All right, folks, why are you hearing Rob Orman's voice instead of mine at the top of the episode? It's because for episode 200, Robbie made me agree that he could interview me, turn the tables, and that's what you're going to hear. There is nothing clinical in this podcast. So if you are looking for that, just turn it off now. Skip to 201 and you will be happy. This is a kind of rambling discussion on various things, on philosophy, on mindset, on the origins of the show. So if that kind of stuff interests you, then listen on. And if it doesn't, then I have no problem whatsoever with you hitting the stop button, the delete button, the throw in the trash button. Understood. Now, who is Robbie Orman? He is one of my best friends. He is a podcaster, started basically the same time MCrit did with ER Cast, one of the first podcasts in emergency medicine. He is now one of the primary voices on MRAP, and he is just a wonderful, eclectic, renaissance man. So let's get right to the interview.
Scotty, how you doing?
I am doing well, Robbie. It's a pleasure to be talking to you, as always.
So what kind of resident were you? Were you the resident that was maybe kind of bookish, but really got the job done? Or were you the guy who would challenge the attendings and call them out on bullshit and say, nope, that's just simply incorrect?
I was the biggest, worst pain in the ass, I imagine, to my attendings. Not deliberately, but two qualities, I think, that really made their lives tough. One is I would ask why about everything, because I was happy to take them at what they said, but I wanted to understand their rationale for why they chose it. Because you know this, Robbie, you'd work with one attending and they tell you this is the only way to do something. And then you'd work with another and they'd have it in a completely different way. And that's great. But I want to understand their rationale. I want to understand what went into their decision that this is how I'm going to manage this particular patient condition. But then the other thing is I was reading everything I could get my hands on. And if they went with a certain direction in clinical care, and I just read something to the contrary, and not just the worst possible situation where these residents are reading really preliminary crap, they have no capability of analyzing the data, and they're just quizzing their attendings on stuff that no one should be doing clinically yet. But or at least this is my opinion. I thought I was pretty good at figuring out, okay, no, this is actually a preponderance of the evidence. This seems like the right way to do it. And I'd suggest that. And now that's the worst thing to do to poor attendings who hadn't seen the articles, because they're immediately backpedaling. And the secure ones would say, okay, well, what did you read? Let's talk about it. Maybe not talk about it right now as we're intubating the patient. Maybe talk about it afterwards. But the ones who are a little less secure, that's a really bad situation to be in, especially like when you're an idiot and you're talking to them about it amongst other people. Just in case the parentheticals got confusing there, I was the idiot in that situation for bringing this new information up amongst other people as opposed to doing it in private. Because for some attendings, they feel like if they haven't read any piece of literature their residents have, and then they're called on it, that the immediate response is, oh no, that's stupid. That's nothing, you know, what the hell are you thinking? And I probably should have let those situations go, but you know me, Robbie, I'm not physically capable of that. So
you are not one to let things go. No.
I've learned some over the years, but yeah, I was a pain in the ass. I got to imagine
it. So that kind of comes up in a little bit of a different way nowadays, because, you know, back in the day, there were no podcasts. There's so many more ways to learn. And someone will say, okay, I heard it on X podcast to an attending. And I think from what I've heard is there's a significant majority of attendings who probably rightly so get irritated by that, you know, when they're challenged about something that they would consider non-peer reviewed or I mean, you know, you can argue about the universal peer review. People are going to call bullshit if you're saying stuff that's wrong. But, you know, how would you suggest that nowadays a resident present that to an attending to make it non-threatening and more educational rather than adversarial? For example, let's say this, apneic oxygenation or the concept of that, and you talk about it in a podcast, and residents say, "Hey, let's put high flow nasal cannula on this, and we'll keep them from desaturating. It's a no desat situation." I heard it on MCRIT. It was great. And the attending would say, "Okay, well, show me the study."
Yeah, this is always a source of trepidation for me. If I had my druthers, residents would never say that, because it just sets up a situation where they're not going to get the information ideally that they want, which is, you know, I've had this idea, but now let's run that through your clinical experience, because you've had more than me as an attending. You know, I'm speaking as the resident now. But again, you know, they're already predisposed not to want to regard that. So if I had my druthers, what they would do is they'd actually read all the source literature that went into the podcast and say, "Hey, I've been coming across a whole bunch of articles, and I'm sort of interested in this concept of apneic oxygenation. What do you think about it?" And they might have known about it. You know,
Wait, that was magic. How you just phrased that was so unresident Scott Weingart to say that. And hey, I'm interested in this topic. I've been hearing about it. What do you think about it? Like presenting it in that way. That's beautiful, because it's more of an open conversation rather than putting someone in a corner.
Yeah, but that would be how I would have presented it as a resident. And that still doesn't get great response, but at least it's better than I heard it on a podcast. Now, I'm sure all the residents out there know some of their attendings who may even be listening to podcasts, or even if they're not, you just know they're totally open-minded. They're secure enough in themselves that they don't get upset when you challenge them. And in those, you could say, "Hey, listen to a podcast last night. They were talking about this. What do you think about it?" And you'll be fine. But you get to know after the first like 3 months, which attendings, you got to be kind of careful what you say. You got to kind of manage them as well as managing the patients. You know, you kind of, you're massaging their ego to keep the shift as enjoyable as possible. Well, maybe bringing up to them, "I heard it in a podcast," not the best idea.
So how did MCRIT get started? I mean, and you know, and along with that, what were some mistakes you made in the beginning, and you look back now and you just shake your head in disbelief?
Okay. MCRIT got started, and you and I, Robbie, were at the right about the same time, and we both had the same realization independently. At the time you and I started, because I think we were amongst the first few, certainly, of EM podcasts out there. There was MRAP, which was amazing, but it was a paid thing. It was quite long. It wouldn't really be in the podcast genre in my mind. It's something different. It's just paid audio CME, and it's fantastic, but it was a little different. Well, so where were the inspirations? Were things like Radiolab, This American Life, and just not the subject matter, obviously, but just the concept of this really intimate connection with people you didn't know, but they were talking into your ears, and they were doing it in a way that's not the same as conversation with a friend, where you're still thinking about your side of it. You're always having to worry about, okay, well, you know, I'm going to be up next. I have to make a joke or a retort, what have you. But this is one-sided. You're receiving it, and you're receiving these really amazing conversations. And I thought, wow, this would be kind of incredible if there was something like this for medicine, for the stuff I care about, and figured I'd give it a shot. And luckily, people seem to like it. Biggest mistake, and it's a clinical one, but if you listen back to the old MCRITs, and I haven't taken them down, and I don't know, maybe people could write in after this and say what they think we should do in the podcasting world with situations like this. But at the beginning of MCRIT, it was right around the time of early goal-directed therapy's heyday, and I was given a lot of fluid to my patients clinically, because that's what the evidence, I think, told us at that point, at least according to most of the world, not the Australians. Even then, they didn't believe it. But I was giving 9-10 liters to some of my patients. I cringe at that now. I would I would never be doing that unless the patient had, like, you know, cholera or something like that.
But why was that? Why is that a mistake? I mean, that's just kind of the using the knowledge at the time.
Sure, and I don't fault myself for it, but it is a. I consider that to be a clinical error. I consider that not to have been the best treatment for my patients. Looking back, and talking about it on the podcast might have popularized that more than it would have been otherwise. More than it would have been if it was just the literature, and I think the literature at the time was good. And I think the national consensus, at least in the United States, was dead on line with what I was saying. But I think I might have done some bad, at least from my current clinical perspective. And that, of all the things on the MCRIT, that's the only one I think is a major departure from what my practice is now.
So what is your process for making a podcast? And let's say a monologue podcast, not an interview, but a monologue podcast like your recent one on tracheostomy emergencies. Now, do you write it out? Do you, you know, kind of do all the research and speak extemporaneously?
Okay. So most of the things I'm going to monologue about mean that I am arrogant enough to feel that I am an expert on the topic, because otherwise I would get a guest, because I only talk about things that I feel I'm pretty good at, or at least as good as anyone I could get onto the podcast who would do a better job than me. So for those kind of topics, I already have a very good operational feeling of the key points. But then what I'll do when I decide to put it up on the podcast is I'll review all the current literature. I'll pull the articles that I felt were really important on the topic, even if they're not new. And most of those I already have waiting for me, the older ones, on crashingpatient.com, which is my non-publicized but freely available virtual brain. And so I'll go through those. And then I'll never write anything out. Generally, the most that'll happen is I'll make an outline and maybe some key points that I want to hit. And if there's any numbers, and anyone who listens to MCRIT knows very rarely am I quoting numbers, but if there's any numbers, those will go on the page as well. But generally, it's just one page of a legal size pad at most in terms of notes.
So what is it? Not that any shift is typical, but you work in a very unique environment, right? You've got an ED ICU, and you're not seeing the undifferentiated chest pain, right? You're seeing the crashing or the sickest of the sick patients. So what is a typical shift for you?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because at my old job, we had a 7-bed unit and it was always full of sick patients. I mean, almost always full of really sick patients. So there was always enough to do without the non-sick. My current unit at Janus General, I mean, at Stony Brook, I think I'm okay. The stuff I'm talking about here, talking about the name. So at Stony Brook right now, we have it's essentially a 25-bed unit.
And in the ED?
In the ED. And there's no way there's going to be 25 critically ill patients. We'll generally have those same 6 or 7. So what winds up happening is a lot of the overflow from the main ED, patients that are a little sicker than maybe you'd want to manage in a standard ED, but at every other ED except for ours and like 2 other places, they certainly would be. So like we're talking like the AFib patient at 160, maybe their blood pressure is a little soft. Maybe it's not even. Maybe it's just AFib at 160. Can you manage that in the ED? Of course, you do that every single day. But it takes up a lot of your nursing time. You know, they have to mix up the DILT, and now that you push it, okay, it wasn't enough. Now we got to go back to the med card and get more DILT. And okay, well, now we want the PO. And so it's a higher intensity nursing patient. When our ED is busy, those will come to our unit. And this helps everyone, because if we're not dealing with the critically ill patient at that moment, because, you know, there's the resuscitative phase, and then there's the sitting there waiting for their ICU bed phase, we'll manage some of those higher acuity standard ED patients. And that'll make sure that our nursing staffing is not being wasted, that the very expensive doctor staffing is not being wasted. And so we'll generally have, you know, a full unit. A lot of them will be admitted critically ill patients. Some of them will be actively resuscitatable critically ill patients. And some of them will just be high acuity ED patients. Like, for instance, any drug overdose where the patient's obtunded comes to us, even though, you know, if they took Ambien, they don't need to be monitored in a critical care unit. They're going to be fine. But our nurses like to have them on end-tidal CO2 very appropriately. They like to have a 1-to-1 sit watching those patients. And it just makes a lot of sense to put them in our unit. So we will see a lot of standard ED stuff over the course of the day, but just like the sicker end of it.
Well, okay, so that was a lot of detail. Well, I want to know, like, what kind of shoes do you wear?
Yeah, sure.
You know, I want to know, like, are you a white coat guy? I'm going to guess not. Okay.
Yep.
Are you a scrubs guy? Shoes? Socks?
Okay. Yeah, got it. Okay, fair enough. So we're going for the really high-level stuff here.
Yeah, who do you think you're talking to?
I'm with you, brother. White coat should be banned from any resuscitative unit, in my opinion. I have always felt the exact way the NICUs feel, which is there should be nothing on your body below your elbows if you're going to take care of critically ill patients. And, you know, the chunky watches, I'm a big fan of dive watches, but they shouldn't be worn, I think, in a critical care unit. They are certainly a nidus for infection. Wedding ring is the only thing that should be down there. I have been a croc aficionado for as long as they've been out there. I had huge amounts of back pain with those Dansko, you know, very expensive Italian surgeon shoes. Never have had a whit of foot or back pain since I switched to Crocs.
Now, are you wearing the Crocs with the holes in them, or you have like a solid Croc?
So I had the ones with the holes on top because I figure maximal ventilation. And what are the odds anything's going to fall through?
100%.
I was about to say. And then a resident dropped a lidocaine anesthesia needle. You know, they had drawn up the syringe and dropped it, and it lodged into the top of my foot. Luckily, it hadn't touched a patient. And I'm like, all right. So then I found ones. And, you know, Crocs are fucking annoying because they'll make them, and you'll find the perfect ones. They fit perfectly. They're great. And then you'll go to order another pair. And they're gone. So
gone.
At this point, if you find ones you like, you order like 8 pairs. But I found ones, they were only available for a while, that had no top holes, but still side holes. Otherwise, you sweat like a dog.
I'm picturing you with the furry Crocs, right? The ones that kind of have the faux rabbit fur.
And the last part, yes, scrubs. Yeah, I again, just like the white coats, I feel anyone taking care of critically ill patients should be wearing scrubs. If you're wearing a fucking tie, I don't want you taking care of my critically ill patient because that shit's going to fall on them at the wrong time. And it's like a nidus for infection. Plus, like, what kind of clothes do you not care about? Like, if you're going to wear nice clothes, they should be clothes you like, and they're going to get trashed in the ED. It's also why I don't understand the people who are wearing gym shoes, you know, or sneakers to a critical care shift. I mean, it's fine, I guess, in an urgent care, though, you know, you're still suturing and stuff, but like, I get blood on me all the time. Like, my shoes are always covered in blood. And once that happens, I could autoclave those fuckers. That's why I like Crocs. Or wash them down with the purple wipes and get them clean. You can't do that with gym shoes. That's disgusting.
All right, so much of your life is dedicated to teaching all of us about ED critical care. And especially residents. I mean, you have residents working with you, you have fellows working with you. So what is your philosophy on teaching? And if you've got a PGY1 and you want them by the end of their residency to really understand the principles of ED resuscitation, both trauma and medical, how do you think they should go about that as far as books, as far as podcasts, as far as like their, I'd say, self-directed learning?
Sure. And I'll get to that, but I want to answer the question I thought that was going to be asking first, if you'll indulge me. And, you know, the philosophies you have in your academic attending life all emerge from your heroes as you were training. And I didn't really find my role model for teaching until fellowship, where I met Tom Scalia, who is my biggest role model and mentor. And a few things that I took from his practice that I made my own were: teaching is the most important thing we could do in medicine, except for one other thing, which is taking care of our individual patient. And anytime those two cross, the patient wins. And where does this come about as a real issue is, okay, tough intubation. How many chances do you give your resident? It all comes down to whether I feel like the patient's going to be declining if I give them one more chance. And there's very few patients they don't get one. But from my perspective, in a patient who's really sick, they get one. A patient who needs a line to get, you know, large volume transfusion or vasopressors when the only thing you have is a crappy 22 gauge in the hand. If that patient's blood pressure is a MAP of 40, they get one shot, and then I'm taking over. But I think the flip side of that is that I feel very comfortable with a lot of things in critical care and resuscitation, and I think I'd allow them more opportunities in a non-crashing patient. So I hopefully that makes it up, because I am confident. I am confident that I could get a central line in even after they miss a few times, as long as it's not harming my patient. So that's the philosophy on procedural stuff, on how to go about bedside teaching of this stuff. It's hard, because you could really inundate a PGY1 with facts and figures and literature. And I don't think that's what they need. I think they need to see how you handle things. I think they need an opportunity to role model. And then they need an active probing of, do you have any questions? Do you have anything you want to talk about that? And probably leave it there. And if there is a fantastic resource that you've come across, maybe giving it to them as an educational prescription and saying, go home and read this, or even printing it out. I mean, I had an attending during residency, Rich Wong, and it was beautiful. He was before the era of understanding how to keep PDFs on a computer, and he would just have a set of draws with like every article he loved ever. And anytime you had anything that was along that, he would photocopy the article from that draw and give it to you. And you had something to go home with on the subway and read. So that, I think, addresses a little bit about educational philosophy in the ED. So you were asking what resources? I don't know. I think every PGY1 should read Rosen's Cover to Cover. Cover to Cover, their first year. I think Tinnanelli's wonderful, but that's not for reading Cover to Cover. That's a book I say go to at the end of a shift where you had a DIC patient, you want to read about DIC. Sure, go to Tinnanelli. It's fucking amazing. But Rosen's is a book you could read cover to cover, and I think you should your first year. And then all of a sudden, everything you get exposed to is already on a background of something you've already read. You might not have understood it perfectly the first time you read it, but you have the words. It's already been primed in your head. Second year, read every monograph on emergency medicine. You read Weinstock's Bounce Backs books. You read Amel's Common Errors in the Emergency Department. You read Steve Smith's EKG book and Amel's stuff as well. You read trauma monographs. You read the books on the hand. You read the Apple's APLS book. You read all of these monographs. Then your third year, then you should be reading Annals of Emergency Medicine. You should be reading Journal of Trauma. You should be reading Critical Care and Intensive Care Medicine, because you should be moving beyond textbooks by that point. And if you did that, no one will. But if you did that, you'd be a fucking monster when you get out of residency.
What do you think, and I want to get back to the idea of resuscitation specifically, what do you think about the Moreno ICU book?
Fantastic. It should have been on my list. Absolutely essential reading for maybe even for first years if you have ICU rotations your first year. Is it the most evidence-based current literature? No. Is it going to give you a basis of physiology and understanding of the stuff people are going to be talking about? Yeah. And it surprises me how well that book's held up.
I want to finish up with a bit of philosophy, kind of what drives you, or what is the foundation upon which you guide your actions? Would you say that you've got core principles that you live by?
Core principles, expertise is one of them, and developing it. And when you're not at the point of expertise, not pretending you are, which maybe is a tangential core principle, but no Dunning-Kruger here if I could ever do anything to avoid it. So a true knowledge of your level of skill, and then pursuing that skill to the furthest point you can, and then mindfulness. And not just meditation. I mean mindfulness in everything in life. Just being aware of the moment, being aware of the things around you, being aware of what's going on. And when you get the tangential side of that, it means not, you know, being locked into the past, not being miserable about things that have happened that are already done. And so I guess that's what I try to live by.
So you and I share a lot of books. And I know we've talked about this before, but I noticed that the type of character you seem to most gravitate for is the iconoclast, right? The there's a solitary male or female character. Actually, it doesn't seem to be important. It's about 50-50, who has almost supernatural powers, but they have those powers because they have put in such focused work and honing a unique skill. But the other side is they're also a little bit on the fringe of what you might think of normal and normal society. Is that how you see yourself?
Holy shit. So as you're saying that, I'm thinking back to every book I love, and pretty much every single one of them fits that mold. Yeah, perhaps it's aspirational, perhaps it's self-identification, but yeah, I think you've really hit on something, and that might be the perfect place to stop before you start getting any other psychological inroads into my character.
All right, Scotty, well done, beautiful man. I hope to do this again at episode 500.
Sounds good. It's locked in, Robbie. It's such a pleasure. You're the best interviewer in emergency medicine, maybe medicine in general. So this is an honor.
This is Rob Orman. Saying bye-bye.